Well, get ready for this coast-to-coast ride tonight, because we've got Whitley Strieber. It's the Grays on Coast to Coast AM. Whitley Strieber is the author of many best-selling novels and works of nonfiction. Four movies have been made from his books. Most recently, the 2004 mega-hit The Day After Tomorrow, based on his novel Superstorm, written with our dear friend Art Bell. Among his best-known novels are The Wolfen and The Hunger, which was made into a film. He also has written other bestsellers, including Billy, Cat Magic, Majestic, War Day, Nature's End, Communion, and Transformation. His most recent book, The Grays, is a thriller about what happens when aliens land. It's being made into a film now by Sony Pictures. In 1999, he co-produced with Mark Wolper a special for NBC based on his book, Confirmation. At present, he and Mark are producing a remake of Wolfen for A&E. He has an internet radio program, Dreamland, and his website, unknowncountry.com, is the most popular edge science website in the world. And he is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Whitley, how are you?
Well, I'm great, George, and it's delightful to be on Coast with you. I think this might be our first time together.
Yeah, our first real time. You were on for just a bit, I think, when we did a little birthday tribute to Art.
Oh, that's right, when we did the birthday tribute to Art. But this is the first time we really have gotten together, and I'm excited because I really have very much enjoyed your work on Coast, and so I'm pumped.
Well, you know what? It was also great meeting you a few weeks ago with your wife, Anne, here in Los Angeles. That, to me, was a treat, Whitley.
Well, for me, too, meeting you and the party we were at, what an amazing group of people. I mean, some of the great, it was just quite an event.
Hey, by the way, I'm reading part of the bio, and they have typed that the special you wrote with Mark Wolper, that was based on Communion, right?
No, the special was based on the book Confirmation.
It was, okay, all right.
Yeah. Yeah, there was a little movie that came out of Communion, but it was a sort of a dud. It did all right in post-release, as DVDs, and they showed it a lot on HBO and so forth. But it wasn't as successful as the other movies. They had a lot of financial problems. The company that made it did, and I did not care for the special effects, and the story was sort of lame. They took my script. I wrote a script for it, but they made a lot of changes in it.
When we got together a couple weeks ago, and I asked you how long you've been a writer, how did that all start? You're telling me about the days when you were a kid that you always had this interest. I've always been fascinated at how people develop, Whitley. Can you tell us that story again?
Well, it was always a fascination of mine. I've been a word person since I was a child, and I found a facility with words when I was the school bus monitor when I was about 12, and I ended up in this ridiculous situation with all these kids, some of them older than me, and all of them interested in hassling the school bus monitor, whoever he happened to be, and so I discovered that I could tell stories. I could make stories up and tell stories and really keep the bus quiet. And it was a kind of urgent sort of storytelling, because one boring sentence and it was over. So I was really singing for my supper there, because their attention spans were not long. And I think that's where I really learned to tell stories, on that school bus.
And what great stories. When you were writing books, did you have any idea that they would start getting turned into movies?
No, I was totally unaware. The movie business was a thing in the distance to me when I first started writing novels. I wrote 7 books before I published The Wolfen, and I would give up every once in a while and throw out my typewriter and clean off the desk and so forth. And a couple days later, it would all reappear again very quietly, and that would be Anne's work in the background, making sure that I didn't actually give up. The first public reader I ever had was a postman, and I had sent a book off to an agent in an attempt to get an agent. And this agent had just dumped the manuscript in a mailbox without even spending 2 cents on an envelope, let alone postage. And a postman had found this 500-page manuscript dumped in this mailbox. He collected the whole thing. My name and address was on the front page of it with the title. And he took it home, and he and his wife read it. And he showed up at my apartment on a Saturday morning with the manuscript.
And said
he had found it in a mailbox, and he thought it was pretty good, and so did his wife. So that was my first public.
Well, you've been a best-selling author. I think you've got another one, by the way, with the Grays. This is just a phenomenal story, and it's fiction. But I have a feeling, Whitley, that there's a lot of reality here. A lot.
Well, yeah, it's like in that sense, it's like Majestic was.
The events that have pushed your career, and I'm talking
right.
primarily about the events in the book Communion, which really got me fascinated with your work, and I think you're just you're one of those at the forefront of this entire field with these events that have happened to you and what you've done over the last several years. How important has that been in your life? I mean, is this something now that has just pushed you and steered you in the direction you're now in, the events that occurred?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's the central event of my life. That night on December the 26th, 1985, is the foundation of my whole life. I had the visitors in my life after that for a total of 11 years until 1997. And they never left my life. I left the country house. We moved away, and they did not follow us. There was people who read my website know there were a few things that happened after that. One big thing may be related to them, which was the meeting with this guy I called the Master of the Key in Toronto
right.
in 1999, but I don't know if he's connected or not. He never said anything like that.
This was a guy who showed up at your hotel room, right?
At the hotel room. Yeah. I thought he was a room service waiter, and he turned out to be something completely different. Anyway, it's been very, very central. And what I'm trying to do with the Grays is to do what I did with Majestic. With Majestic, I had a call. It was the most extraordinary thing. I had written Communion and had a call from one of my father's brothers, my uncle Mickey Strieber, Colonel Edward Strieber, who proceeded to say that he had been at Wright Field when the Roswell material was brought there and was well aware of it, and he wanted to introduce me to his commanding officer, General Arthur Exon, who I met over the telephone, and General Exon proceeded to tell me that he had been Air Force liaison to the group which was called the Majestic Group, which has actually had another name, but it was apparently classified,
right.
for years. And he went through this whole thing about what had happened, and he said to me that everyone from Truman on down had known that this thing was not of this world within 24 hours of their finding it. It was extraordinary, and I couldn't believe that these two men, both of them very, very well-respected Air Force officers, both of them heavily involved in intelligence work, were having me on. What they were doing must have been something that they had been asked to do by somebody whose orders they were following. I can't believe that it would have been anything else, but I ended up with all this information and no proof, no documentation. Art Exon gave one brief interview to someone I'll hopefully remember the name of the book, in a book about the Roswell incident, and that was it. Mickey never said a word, one, to anyone else. So I wrote fiction based on what I believe to be fact about that, and I've done the same thing with the Grays.
You know, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you're right, because you couldn't have that hard evidence, but you're crying to tell the public what you know, and that's probably the best vehicle to do it.
Well, the beauty of fiction is that people can who understand this or who are close to it, who have had close encounters or studied this, are going to be able to identify the parts of this book that are real. But I can't be faulted for giving away official secrets or anything, but I've never been, like, I'm not privy to any official secrets. I've never signed a security oath, and no one has ever told me anything that they proceeded to say to me, this is an official secret, don't tell anybody. So I don't know any of that stuff. But I have connected a lot of dots. I was asked a lot of questions by people from the government, asked questions in the late 80s and early 90s, and I connected dots from those questions. I didn't get much information back, but I did connect dots. And the book, a lot of those dots are connected in the book.
Were they trying to find out, Whitley, what you knew, or were they trying to find out how much you knew?
Well, there were two things that happened. The first thing was they were trying to figure out what was happening, because I think it's quite obvious internally, inside parts of the intelligence community, that there is something here. I don't think it's a big issue with them. I don't think it's a huge, massive cover-up. But they know that there's something brewing that they don't understand. And there is no question whatsoever about any president ever making a statement about it as it now is understood. Jimmy Carter, when he went into office, said that he was going to reveal all about UFOs, and he never did.
Never did.
But the main reason I was given, I think, and this is the true reason, is that I was given a half a dozen reasons. But the main reason is this. A president cannot say that these UFOs are real, because then he's going to have to also say that the abductions, the contact experiences are probably real too, because who's going to believe that somebody is floating around here from another world or another dimension, but never landing? I mean, especially when millions of people are saying this is happening to them.
Exactly. And the fact that then we can say, well, they've been lying to us, they've been withholding information, how much are they holding back now?
Well, right, and then the worst part for them is they have to say, yes, this is probably happening to a lot of people. We don't know what's going on, and we can't do anything about it. And now the press conference is over. Goodbye.
Yeah.
This just isn't going to happen.
I agree with that.
Because unless they have some knowledge or some control over the situation, this is simply not going to happen.
I still think if they did, there'd be a breakdown in society, and they would not, as much as I would like to believe we're all educated, we can all handle the truth, I don't think the masses in general can handle this.
Well, you know, I got, and Annie read, God lover, a 500,000 letters about this from people. And, George, you would be surprised at how well they handle it. First of all, it's a complete myth. The myth is, in the scientific community, and there's even been a book published about this silly folk, it is scientific folklore, recently, that that people wake up in the middle of the night, they have the abduction experience, and then they're hypnotized into believing it was an alien contact. And it's a sort of culturally mediated hallucination. These letters just totally throw that whole theory into a cocktail. Maybe a couple of hundred people mentioned that kind of locomotion to their experience. The number who had been hypnotized was infinitesimal. The great majority of these people, they were having these experiences with their families, often during the day, right in the middle of the broad daylight. I mean, people drive up to their country house, and there are these aliens in the darn trees in one case. Another case, a lady's vacuuming her front room, and she looks up, and there's one of the grays standing there. It isn't like they say in the scientific press. It's different, and it's huge. It's millions of people. But the point I'm trying to make is, these letters, they were reasonable, they were intelligent, and they were all kind of saying the same thing. hey, what the heck's going on here? You know, that was basically the term. They weren't panicked. But I think if people who haven't had contact experiences are told this could happen and we have no idea what it is.
And we can't stop it.
And we can't stop it. That's the key. This will cause fear.
Yes.
You're right there.
Absolutely. We're gonna bring Ann in at the half to chat with us for a little bit, Whitley. She's got some great events to talk about as well. But why did you end up leaving the cabin in upstate New York? I mean, it was just because you wanted to move, or was there something else?
You know, I really can't answer that question. Annie thinks we were sort of pushed out. In other words, we were kind of pushed out into the world because we had this other task to do.
Yeah.
And it involved getting out in the world. There was a huge thing that happened down in San Antonio when I met Bill Mallow of the Southwest Research Institute. I was able to actually start researching implants with electron microscopes and
mm-hmm.
stuff. Never would have happened. There were other people up there who were in close contact, and there was a tendency when that happened to you to really want to just kind of roll up the rug, because it's a big experience. It's a big life to live in this thing. It's complicated. It's not all beautiful and good. Don't get me wrong about that. But you don't want to leave it. And it was the hardest thing I ever did to leave, but we were kind of compelled to.
You know, a lot of people will listen to this interview with you tonight, Whitley, and with Ann, and shake their head in fear, shake their head in glory and glee as well, because at one point, it is kind of scary to know and believe we're being visited. On the other hand, it's kind of refreshing to know we're not alone in this universe, isn't it?
The way in which we're not alone is a question I haven't answered yet. I can assure you, we are not alone. That, I swear, anyone listening, if you want to hear the sincerity in my voice, it's there. As far as what they are, that is a question I have not answered, and I have been face to face with them. I have touched them, and I still don't know what they are.
I mean, have they ever told you, or are they, if they have, are they trying to mislead you?
I don't know, George, if they have told me or not. One of the big things about the Grays is it shows on two different levels, or three different levels, rather, the struggle to communicate. And it is a huge struggle. I spent 11 years learning this and trying to do this. And to get information from them that's really reliable in the sense of I understand what they're trying to communicate, that's just terribly hard. They do not talk except on rare occasions I've heard words, very rare. Mostly it was a matter of quieting my mind enough, and then gradually, these pictures would start to come, and there would be a kind of a communication that would evolve that way. But that's not how we communicate, and it's very hard to make sense of it, especially when they get fast and the things start flashing past fast, and it turns into symbolism, and I'm just lost.
Well, stick with us, Whitley. Whitley's website, as I mentioned, by the way, unknowncountry.com, is the most popular-edged science website in the world. The few of you who have not gone to it, go ahead, because you're in for a real treat. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Whitley's wife, Anne, about some incredible things that have happened to her in her life as well. And then we'll come back. Whitley will be with us for the whole night. We'll take phone calls later on at the end of this program. He'll be with us when Ann's on, because we'll come back and talk about this incredible story called The Grays. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Whitley Strieber, and we're going to be joined this half hour with Whitley's wife, Anne, whom I also had the wonderful opportunity to meet several weeks ago here in L.A. Hey, Whitley, we're going to keep you on with us. Anne, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, George?
Great. You know what? You look wonderful when I met you, and I am so convinced that prayer works. It is unbelievable. I mean, I'm glad that you're feeling better. You look great, and thanks for coming on the program today.
Well, it's a joy to be here. And, you know, I have a lot of Coast listeners to thank for the fact that I am here.
You sure do. I mean, they love you.
But they helped me. They helped me when I needed it.
I believe that. There is no doubt in my mind that that this consciousness, this power of the mind, helps when you needed it the most. And you made just a tremendous recovery. And I'm so glad. I'm so glad. And Whitley, that's got to be a relief for you, my friend.
Yeah, and you know, we both. I want to join Ann in thanking the Coast listeners. I will never forget that night, and that Art suddenly was on the phone because of the love of all things. It turned out it was the night I was supposed to go on Coast with him, and I told what had happened, and not only did Coast listeners who were associated with the hospital throw their clothes on in the middle of the night and come down to help us, but the prayers, I am absolutely convinced, got Annie through a situation that was really, really terrible, and one from which recovery is not normal, not usual, not complete recovery, but she's been left with no deficits. She's in great shape.
Well, you know, when I was reading not only the book The Grays, but the website and the article that Anne had posted just a few days ago about Grays, A Love Story, I really did. I thought about you two. And after seeing you two together in action out at that party, I mean, how close you two are, I kind of envy it, to tell you the truth. And I'm so glad that things are working out for both of you. And this book, The Grays, you've looked at it with a different perspective. And I'd like you to tell us about that very special feeling about The Grays that really only you can explain.
Well, of course, I'm married to Connor, and anybody who reads the book will know what that means. I've got Connor. He's complex. I'm crazy about him. Been married to him a long time. And also, I think the story that Whitley wrote about Dan and Caitlin in the book, I think that's our story.
I think so, too.
And I don't remember it clearly, but I just think that we were together before, whenever that was, and that we were meant to be together because we met in such an odd way, in such a serendipitous way, if that's the right word. And I just think that it's our story, really. The Grays is our story.
When you talk about being together, are you saying possibly in another life or maybe in some kind of abduction or scenario, something like that?
Maybe both.
Or maybe both.
Maybe both, yes. If you believe in other lives and lives going on after we die or maybe before we were here, I'm not a person who's very interested in belief, but lately I keep meeting all sorts of mediums and psychics. They seem to be just falling into my life, and I'm just very lucky, and they all believe in that. So they're the ones who should know, aren't they?
Whitley, do you believe this too?
Well, you know, I had for years a memory, it's very vague, of meeting a girl very much like Anne when we were children, little children. And the thing that's odd is that she grew up in Michigan and early on in Alabama, and I was in Texas, and I never went to those places. And we met in such a peculiar way. We were both living in New York, just totally alone. Both of us had gone there because that's the big city. We went for the lights, and I saw this ad in the Village Voice for something called Mind Mates. And I was looking for girls, of course. 23 years old, alone in a big city.
Sure.
I was looking for girls.
Thumbing through those pages fast, huh?
Yeah, and so I filled out their form, and it was a long, complex form. And I'll never forget the day I walked into this little office where Anne was working, and I walked up to this beautiful receptionist and looked down at her and said, I'm looking for Anne Maddox. And she said, I'm Anne. and I nearly collapsed.
I love it.
That was the beginning of a pretty long love affair.
Those are the days we would say yes when things like that would happen.
And it's been like, from the very first moment, it was like we were old friends. And that's why in the Greys, Dan and Caitlin, the parents of Connor in the Greys, are brought together as children, that sort of reflects my thoughts about what might be buried somewhere in our lives.
And do you have recollections of being abducted? Has that occurred to you? Has that happened?
I have some vague memories that I might have, but my role is not really to interact directly with the Greys. You know, we all have to accept and find our roles in life. My role is to be the family skeptic, to say to Whitley, now hold it now, you don't know that for sure. And my role is also to interact with other people who have had these experiences, to be a listener. And I just meet them everywhere. People who are shy about coming up to Whitley come up to me and tell me their stories, and I've heard so many stories.
Well, what do you think of Whitley's story? I mean, do you think that his contacts are real? Do you think he just believes them to be real?
Oh, no. He's very careful. He's very skeptical. He's very objective. Neither of us is very interested in believing this. I mean, it's something to experience. It's not something to believe. And, you know, people may turn UFOs into a religion the way they turn everything else into a religion. But it's not a religion. It's experience. And I find a lot of the people who are in the official UFO organizations have really created a UFO religion, I guess, to replace their regular religion.
What was it like with these events that were unfolding? With Whitley primarily, and I mean, did other people talk about that? You know, I had heard about a possibility that someone, a neighbor, had seen light over the house. I mean, did these events continue to crop up in both your lives?
Oh, yeah. It was very odd because we got this country house, and because our little boy needed to go out in the country and run around with his friends, and we seem to have moved into a hotbed of UFO activity, but we didn't know anything about it. I mean, we didn't realize that when we moved there, but it turns out that everybody we met, these were very, what you might call, ordinary people. I mean, it seemed like all of them had seen something odd or experienced something odd or knew somebody who'd seen something odd, and it was just one story after another. And as I say, these were the salt-of-the-earth type folks. These were not, we were living at the time in New York City, but these were people who were, you know, they were state troopers and carpenters, and I mean, just very ordinary folks, but they were all having very strange and anomalous experience. It was fascinating.
When our next door neighbor came over, though, I remember that was, it was for me a confirming moment, too, because it was about March or April, I guess, after this had happened. It was in other words, in the first quarter of 1986, and I was still very iffy indeed about what was going on. And he asked me, and I remember Annie's jaw just sort of dropped when he asked this question, about this light that he saw appearing over our house at night. And that was shocking.
Like a beam?
No, it was like a star, like a bright light.
Ah,
like
okay.
Hanging, maybe, he said it was about 50 feet above the house.
Okay.
And that it would make a sound, a faint sound.
I love it.
Yeah.
Were others in that neighborhood, and I don't know what the geography was of where the cabin was, but I mean, was there great space and distance between the other houses, or were you
pretty
close?
It was a little forested development with a dirt road, and each cabin had maybe 4 or 5 acres of land around it, and it was woods. Mostly, they were in woods. It wasn't clear. So you couldn't see one house from another, but you could see, like, for example, our neighbor, if he looked up toward our house, could see above it, above the trees. But he couldn't see into our yard without coming over through the trees.
Probably easier to see in the fall when the leaves started to fall, I guess, than the summertime.
Yeah, it would have been, absolutely.
Go ahead.
So we have, I think that the most bizarre experience of the neighbors was the state trooper that Ann mentioned told me that he had thought he had seen the abduction experience.
Oh, that was weird. Yes.
It was really weird. He and his wife were coming home from a party about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning on that night, and he saw a big, what he thought was a crashed dirigible in a field, but it was dark, and you could just see this big gray lozenge-shaped object in the field, and he pulled over because he's a state policeman. He was retired at that point, but he felt that he should stop and try to help whoever it was, obviously, especially if it was a crashed blimp or a plane even. He wasn't sure what exactly it was. So he pulled over and climbed across a barbed wire fence, which could do easily. I mean, he knew what he was doing when it came to wire. They all did up there, these country people. And he starts walking toward the thing, and he could hear someone screaming.
I was going to say, you have that in the Grays. You have a scene like that, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And anyway, then suddenly it turned on all these lights all over. He said it lit up like a Christmas tree and started coming toward him. And his wife went berserk, freaked out in the car. And because, you know, this is an area where these stories are kind of underground all over the place,
right,
in that part of the neck of the woods. And he finally went back and figured, well, one thing is certain. This thing is not in any trouble, but I might be. So he got back in the car and drove off. And he felt bad about the fact that he hadn't tried harder to help me, because he said, I think it was you in there.
He was right.
I think he was. It could have been somebody else. I mean, they could have been, who knows? I mean, they could have had a regular abduction assembly line going on there that night. But interestingly enough, just a couple of months ago, this is amazing how this goes on. Someone wrote me a letter saying that they had been working in the guardhouse of the Mohonk Mountain House, which is about 5 miles away from where we were, up on a big mountain, big for that part of the country, and that there had been quite a big display of unusual lights in the sky over there right after Christmas that had been dismissed by the police as a meteor or something, but he had seen them, or she had seen them, if I've got the story right, or knew someone who had, and thought that this was connected also.
Do you think that this, let's say visitation, for lack of a better word, was done on purpose with you, Whitley and Ann, or was it just random?
What do you think,
Annie? Why don't you react to that and see what you have to say?
Well, you know, people wrote us so many letters, and sometimes people would say, why did they choose me? But I don't think that people are chosen. Maybe I'm wrong. But I think what it is that only certain people, for some reason, can see them. And I think,
in other words, it's happening to a lot more people even than we think.
That's interesting.
Yes, I think. But that's just my impression after meeting so many people and hearing so many stories. I think that I don't think people are chosen. I think that just certain people can see them, and it might be a quantum phenomenon. They are quantum beings, and we have to understand a little bit more about quantum physics before we can understand them. I think that's what I think. I think only certain people can see them. I don't think it's that they wave a magic wand and say, I'm going to choose this one. Although I sometimes suspect, I hate to contradict myself, but I sometimes suspect that they have chosen Whitley.
And have you ever, because of Whitley's involvement with them, have you ever witnessed them or gotten to the point where you maybe saw them from a distance or anything like that?
I haven't seen from a distance. Whitley once asked them to show me something because he was getting so frustrated with them having all the experiences by himself.
Yeah.
And so we had a hot tub, and we'd go outside and laze around in the hot tub and watch the stars. And he said, you know, please show Ann something, show her a UFO so she can, you know, believe me and see what I see.
Right.
And they have a wonderful sense of humor, and they showed me what looked like a big pile of wood in the sky, all lit up with, it looked like a bunch of firewood, all lit up
with lights. Like Christmas tree lights.
Yes.
It was the most ridiculous UFO I've ever seen in my life. And it went over the house at an altitude of 50 feet, and she says, "That's a UFO?" And the firewood flew over the house and slowly went down into a draw behind the house and went away again, making a kind of buzzing noise. It was ridiculous.
Now, are you both convinced that what we're dealing with happens to be physical in this reality? And when I say physical, I'm the kind of guy that say, okay, we have these planets, we can see this, we see comets. There's a physical end to this universe. When I talk about UFOs, I like to talk about it in either those terms or, as other people think, extra-dimensional. They might even be demonic. Who knows? We'll talk about that with you later on, Whitley. But do you think this is more physical?
Yeah, people have touched them. And what's interesting to me is everyone who has touched one of these visitors, one of these grays, people who never met each other and never corresponded with each other, they all described it the same exact way.
Now, that's fascinating.
Also, they have allergic reactions.
Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah.
And I'm not going to tell you what the way is, because I don't want, if I hear any more descriptions, I want to know it's a real one.
Exactly. And Whitley,
there is something that we've held back about the whole business of touch, but I haven't held back the allergic reaction thing, which is intense. I had allergic reactions initially, and I warned, we had groups of people up to the cabin to meet the visitors. And here's another thing that Anne does that's really, in my opinion, very weird. She's the one who chooses, she knew just who, of all those thousands of letters we were getting, she would pick out the people that she thought should come to the cabin. And we would get these groups of people, and that was just extraordinary, because they would, visitors would sometimes would show up when these people were there, and physically show up. And one time,
people's beds, remember?
Yeah, and I would say, be careful, don't touch them, because you'll get an allergic reaction. And this lady, Raven Dana, is a wonderful person. She's even talked about, she might have even been on Toast with me in art years ago. One of them showed up when she was in the room, in her bedroom, and held out its hand, and she did touch it. And then by the next morning, she was just swollen closed. I mean, she was really, I have a picture of her.
Well, now, what do you think it was about them, what about their makeup, that would cause this kind of reaction or rash?
An allergic reaction? Well, I think I'm not a doctor, but I think that it's a, it just, it's, I guess, something that happens. I mean, they tried various ways of suppressing this with me, and one of them involved sticking me with a little needle, like very much like the needles allergists use. But the result of it was ridiculous, because I couldn't feel my skin for like 24 hours, and I felt like I was living in a tent. When I took a shower, I could hear the shower but not feel it.
Oh, fascinating.
I could feel a sort of bumping on the inside of my body. It was very weird. So what it is that causes the allergies, I don't know, but it does happen.
All right, Whitley, stay with us. Anne, I want to thank you again for being on the program, and I'm glad you're doing well, Anne.
Oh, thanks. It's been a lot of fun.
Okay, Whitley Strieber will be back in just a moment. The website, again, unknowncountry.com. We'll be back. Whitley, you're going to be on with Art Sunday, first hour. That's going to be kind of neat to have you two reunited.
Oh, yeah, it's going to be great. I haven't heard word one from him since he moved to the Philippines. I figure he's been pretty busy with his new family and new wife, so I haven't really interfered, but I'm real eager to get back together.
He is very happy. He's patching his life together, and he's doing very well up there in the Philippines, and we've got the ISDN lines in there now, as you know. So
right.
It'll save you a phone call, Whitley. At least you'll be able to talk to him that way.
Huh? Yeah, that's right.
the story, The Grays, and again, though it's fiction, there's a lot of foundation to it, and there's a lot of truth. There are some people out there who are saying, well, what do you mean by the Grays? Explain to us how that term happened, Whitley, and what these beings look like.
Okay, well, I've been exposed to basically three different kinds of non-human looking creatures. The first and one that the ones I have seen the most of are what I call, and what a lot of people call, the grays, because they have a gray color and in their skin. And now there's also other levels of it, because it's hard to really come down to what they are in terms of good versus evil. I mean, they're very much like us in that, you know, if you ask, is the human race good or evil, you really can't answer that question. And it's the same. People say, well, the gray is good or evil. And it's just not an answerable question. I've had incredibly creepy and scary things connected with some grays. Other grays I have had wonderful experiences with. And I will say that they took an interest in my moral life. We can talk about later. That was very
sure.
Stunning. But get down to what they look like. Now, I'll tell you about the ones I've seen clearly. Okay.
All right.
I've seen clearly a type of gray which is about 4 feet tall. They act and function fairly independently, and they move pretty much like we do, with a sort of flowing motion in their step. Very long, thin arms and long, thin hands with claw-like fingers that are almost snaky. They don't seem to be like they work more like snakes than like they had muscles, like they had bones in them. Big black eyes that are wrapped around the sides of their heads that I would almost believe could be some kind of a covering. I wouldn't be too surprised if they could take that off and there would be something else underneath.
Like some kind of a helmet as opposed to some kind of a biological skin?
Like glasses. Like dark glasses.
Okay.
Not a helmet, but dark glasses. The other grays I've seen are smaller and seem to operate in groups of three. And they seem to be, to need that. And people often, if you read between the lines of abduction experiences, there's often an approach where the person will see if they happen to be outside, like in a case in British Columbia a couple of years ago, a very extraordinary case. I don't remember offhand whether or not the lady has said her name publicly, so I'm not going to say it, but some of the listeners probably know the name if it has been said. And in any case, she saw these three stars in a triangular formation moving across the sky. And when people see this, what they are seeing is actually three grays. It's not, they're in that, in a form that are, that whether it's a vehicle or something much more advanced than a vehicle, I don't know. But I do know this: when one of these lights goes out, there's nothing there but one of these little grays. There's no ship, in other words.
Okay.
I've seen that happen. And they will always, seem to always be in groups of three. And that's why I have the triad, the group of three working together in the book. Because I saw that. That's what I saw.
Great illustration, by the way, by Dana Augustine on the coasttocoastam.com website. He does a lot of work for William Henry, right?
He does, and also he does the mastheads for Dreamland every week.
Right.
On unknowncountry.com.
Okay.
And in any case, those are the two types of gray I have seen. Now, I also had a long conversation with and saw some blondes. I didn't, which we call also Nordics. Two of them showed up in my apartment in New York, and they were big. And they asked me right before the Communion book tour started. It was a very grueling experience because I was at that initial time greeted with laughter and incredulity almost everywhere I went. And they asked me, what can we do? What would you like from us, or words to that effect. And I very stupidly, seeing how big they were, said, you could show me one of your children. Because I just have to tell you that I'm never very good at those moments. And that was one of the, they kind of asked them to give me a UFO or something. I probably would have anything.
Right. Give me a map. Give me something. Yeah.
Something, some proof, something to take out with me. And instead I asked this question, but it just popped out of me. But then I met another one, and this was interesting. I talked to him for a long time on the telephone, and his whole story is reflected in the Grays, including his ideas and what he thought and what he was all about, and my thoughts about his maybe possible relationship with the government and an interface that was going on in the story, goes on in the story, between his people and ours in the foothills above Boulder, Colorado. It's all in the book, and how much truth there is in all of it, I'm not sure. I can't document it, but I think there is certainly an element of truth there. And he was adamantly opposed to the Grays. He said they were dangerous and to stay away from them.
Did you get the impression that they were physical, like humans in some respect, or robotic or almost humanoid, where maybe, you know, they were androids rather?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I think when you're looking at the Grays, you're seeing a whole complex of beings which have been long since have involved in genetic manipulation of their, if that's what they do, if they even have genes of their own species. And you're seeing some beings that are purpose-built maybe for what they do. You're seeing some that are seem to be kind of limited in certain ways, others that are just highly, highly active and highly intelligent, and others that are dependent upon this group of three. And I didn't mention there's another group of aliens I saw, especially on that first night, which were these blue creatures that were frog-like almost. They moved very quickly, and they seemed to be kind of associated with the Grays somehow.
Could you call them the reptilians?
No, they weren't. They weren't like that. I've never seen. I've heard stories about that, and thankfully, never ran across any of them out in the woods at night when I was for this experience.
Really? Yeah.
No, that I didn't even know about in those days, and certainly didn't see. These little blue ones seemed to be kind of like worker bees, and what they were, what their minds were like, I just don't know. But, you know, there's so much, 11 years of this experience and so little of it written down. I'll give you an example from our lives of how this unfolded. My son, when he was about 12, had a friend that was iffy. This kid was really iffy. And the lady who's on the cover of Communion showed up in our lives a lot then, and she showed up one night when this kid was at the country house and did not like him. She projected into my mind all of these images of my son getting into dangerous situations with him, and it was really amazing. I mean, I was seeing him through her eyes. I didn't see her, but it was certainly obvious that she was around, because the next morning, the boy, she kept putting her hands around the edge of the door of the boy's bedroom and moving her hands. You know, their hands are scary looking. And that kid, we never saw him again. That was it. He was gone. She sort of was running that family, you know. She had taken us under her wing, and I used to tell the parents very frankly of the children who were coming up there that this was happening and it was real. And I never found a single parent who did not want their kids to come up there, and I never felt the kids were in jeopardy either. There was no sense of that. They used to see these little beings out in the woods, and this fellow that would stay near them and watch them, kind of watching over them when they were playing out in the woods. And there was also workmen who would see them. And I had these fellows one time pulling poison ivy out of some trees that were near where the kids were playing and had been playing. And I just wanted that ivy out of there. And I had four or five guys in there pulling it out. And their foreman comes up to me and the house and knocks on the door. He says, "Mr. Strieber, we're leaving." And this was long after communion. Everybody knew about the visitors. And I said, "Oh, have you finished?" He says, "No, we're not finished. And we're not going to charge you anything. But we're leaving because there's one of those Leylands is walking around out on your road out there, and we don't want anything to do with it."
I'd love it.
That was really, those were really incredible peak years. I mean, whether you characterize this as a good experience, a bad experience, them as evil, or as you say, they're demons or whatever they may be, I don't know. But having this experience, wow, I mean, I wouldn't trade it for anything. I'm glad I went out in those woods on those nights because that's what brought it back to me.
Well, Whitley, did they ever try to communicate to you in terms of where they were from, why they were here?
A few things that they said, the words I got were, as far as why they had come here, "We saw a glow." I mean, isn't that informative?
That's what they said?
What does that mean?
They saw a glow.
We saw a glow.
We were the glow?
I don't know. Could have been anything. Maybe the glow of cities. Maybe something. Maybe the glow of our souls. Who knows?
Maybe a nuclear explosion.
Maybe it was the bomb that hit Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Yeah, I mean, exactly.
No way of telling. But what that might have meant, it meant so many things. So like what they said to Phil Corso, Colonel Corso. He told me face-to-face of his experience, and I'm pretty sure this is also in his book, of confronting one of them in a cave who said he asked and had been asked, "What's on offer for us here? Is there anything for us in this?" And the answer was, "A new world if you can take it." And when he said that to me, I thought, this man is not lying. Whether he was in that cave or he just heard about somebody having this experience, that's the kind of thing the Greys will say because it is so dense with meaning. If you can take it, it means everything. If you can take it, that is to say, if we can wrest it from them, if we can take it from the universe, if we can bear it, if we can stand it, if we can stand the change, a new world. And is it going to be a world like this world? Absolutely not. Is it going to be a world we can handle? Sure is, or it wouldn't even be on offer. I think if we take the brass ring, we might get a real surprise. It might be a better life for mankind.
I think you're right.
But, and never forget this, if this thing starts to emerge at any time in the future, people are going to start to get very excited and say, "Oh, how wonderful, how cool. Please, I know the Greys well. Don't forget to cut the cards."
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. Did you ever see them running around? Did they show you any kind of speed or dexterity?
Yes. They are very dexterous. And there was someone, now this gets into the area of hybrids, but there was a gentleman, a fellow, I've mentioned him, I might have mentioned him in Breakthrough. I came across what I thought was an 11-year-old boy in the woods behind our house smoking a cigarette under a tree. And it was in August and it was really dry, about 1993, I guess, or 4. And I wanted to say, you know, be careful with the matches and things out here. As I walked up to him, it became obvious this was no little boy. I was about a mile or mile and a half back in the woods too. And he made this sort of low growling sound when I tried to talk to him and just continued to stare straight ahead.
Yeah.
And what he looked like was someone who had aged to age 11 and then stayed that like that and was maybe 50. You know, it was sort of weathered. It was weird-looking guy. And so I thought, well, you know, it's basically time to just turn and run here. And that's what I did. And I went back to the house, and he stayed in those woods. And we decided, but he had, you knew he was back there because he would put together little redoubts of stone that were, where he picked the stones so well that they just fitted together like a puzzle. Or he would make things out of little lean-tos, out of limbs and stuff that were woven together like basket weaving, like he had seen two limbs and he had known just that those two would fit together perfectly and fit them together. They were quite amazing, these little structures. Then I decided to go out and take pictures of them. Went out with the camera, they were all gone. And, you know, that dexterity was incredible.
I would assume that it's probably still going on in that region. Do you get reports from neighbors about what might be happening there still?
Well, there was a fellow someone with a rather heavily disguised email address who went on my message boards on my website for a few times, who I know was from that area because of the way he described intimate details of life up there and of the geography. And I think that certain people are heavily involved up there, and they keep very much to themselves. I think they just sort of roll up the rug and live in this. And because you can, you know, I mean, I was on my way to doing that when we had the sort of shock that made us leave in a way. And I'll tell you what it really precipitated. First, Annie was really lonely out there. She was very alone, and she was just sitting and reading books and not having much involvement. I was heavily involved.
Yeah.
I was having these wonderful meditations with sessions with the Grays every night. And I think it's in this diary that she put on the website. So I will say this. I don't talk about anybody's experiences in the family unless they talk about it.
Sure.
So she came into the room one night right before they showed up, and she sat down, and they showed up, and they would come, and they would be thud, thud, thud on the roof. They were not silent. And here's the thing though. They come, there's these thuds on the roof, the thuds of heavy bodies hitting the roof. Then they come down through the roof, okay?
Like they dematerialized through the roof?
I don't know how they did it.
But there were no holes there, right?
No.
Stay with us, Whitley. Let's take this quick break. We'll come right back. Great story. Whitley Strieber, our guest. Whitley, so they were plopping down on your roof and then somehow coming through the house, not really creating any damage or anything like that.
No. And that happened night after night for a long time. And there was a long period when one of them would wake me up. And this is amazing. I mean, how would I possibly, when I think about back on it, who would sleep? But I did, and we did. And
I couldn't. I'd have my eyes open, for crying out
loud. Of course. So would I now, but at the time it seemed like the most normal thing in the world. They were real interested in meditating together, real interested in that. And I was just going to say that night, Annie came in. And she heard them land, and then you would feel them in the room before you could see them, and they would never get near me. The closest they would get would be to stand behind me and put their hands on my shoulder. But if I even thought about turning around, the hands were gone. They were really concerned about, I think they're very fragile, would be my guess.
Maybe.
Or something, and they just they were not willing to trust my movements at all. But in any case, as soon as that started to develop, she suddenly said, "I'm not ready for this." And she got up and left and went into the other room, and they didn't follow her, and I didn't expect them to. And, I went on with the meditation, and they were, but then after that, it seemed like somehow or another, something depended on leaving. And, you know, our son had grown up by that time and was away at college and no longer really needed the country house. And, she wanted more social life, and we were not doing as well financially as we had been in the past. And so I thought maybe we would move down to Texas where the living was a little cheaper and get rid of the house, and that's what we did.
Do you miss that area?
Oh, yeah. And as time goes by, I miss them more and more, more than I ever thought I would.
So the visitations have stopped, Whitley?
Well, there were a few things that happened down in Texas, but that was years ago. The last thing that happened, as I said, was the fellow, the Master the Key guy, who I don't think, I mean, he never said he was connected with them, so I don't know if he was or not, but since then there hasn't been much of anything. There have been some very interesting experiences involving time lately, but no kind of contact, and I must admit that I do miss it. I miss it more than I ever thought I would, because at the time it was really very scary, and there were threats. In other words, the reason this man was in the woods behind our house, he was a sort of guardian, and therefore, I think probably for good reason, because the local people word was getting around about this, that this was real, and there were people out there who did not like that, and they really wanted me out of there, and we had gotten a couple of pretty serious threats, and I think anyway that he was there to watch over us, and he came down to Texas. He showed up in the condo complex, and I mean, it was not a private, it was a little condo complex,
yeah.
And we were down on the ground floor in this little apartment, and there was no real place for somebody like that, and the people in the complex were calling Texas State Social Services because they saw what looked like a feral child wandering around in the condo complex. And he used to stand in there was a little cul-de-sac beside our bedroom where there was a porch, and it was dark there, and he would stand there close to us at night. And I finally put a motion-sensitive light there, and the light would go on every time he came in there, and he quit standing there. And one day, he burst around the corner and went stalking off down the middle of the street. And that was the last, I think, of the visitors in my life.
That's strange. What about their technology, Whitley? Did you ever witness craft or anything? Because I know in the book, The Grays, you talk about technology, but I think you were making reference to U.S. technology.
Our technology, yeah. I know a lot more about than I do about theirs. What I know about their technology is this. It has something to do with gravity, and it is not something I think we've cracked. I don't think that there is a secret world of people who have cracked this technology and are flying around in the universe that are, and this is being hidden from the rest of us. I think that we haven't cracked it, and that we have had enough debris and enough pieces to know that it's physical, at least at times, but we don't know what this stuff is, whether we're looking at something that is moving across dimensions or through time, or that it has some kind of relationship to gravity that we don't understand. We don't know anything about that. Our technology, though, that's another story. I'm pretty well convinced that the Aurora plane, the aircraft, that was so much money was spent on, it does not work, was that basically there was the Defense Department gave the Skunk Works, the Lockheed Skunk Works, some years ago, back in the early 60s, a list of capabilities, which were essentially the capabilities they had observed UFOs had, and asked them to build a plane that could do that. And the result was the Aurora program. Now, before there was a black budget, I used to see the Aurora planes budget in the United States budget that was published every year.
So they'd have it just written right in there.
Yeah, right. Now they claim it never existed at all. But that's not true. It did exist. Not only did it exist, there were elements to it, such as it had an ability to turn really very much on a dime and at high speed. And there was a call at one point within the medical community for orthopedic experts to help the pilots who were trying to fly this thing because it had a counterforce suit that they wore that was supposed to counterforce the G's from these rapid turns. And when I heard about all of this, I thought to myself, this is an attempt to make something like what the visitors have.
Right.
This isn't even close. And I thought to myself, this is like a cargo cult where people in New Guinea, after the Air Force came during World War II, they started trying to build, they saw the Air Force guys bring all these wonderful things out of these airplanes, and so they built bamboo airplanes and built their own airfields and their own refrigerators made out of bamboo, and they walked around making noises that they sent that to them sounded like the airmen and opening refrigerators and hoping for beer to come out.
Yeah, yeah.
It was about the same level of thing. And, you know, we're not there yet. But our technology is still, there are certain areas where we've made great progress. And the TR aircraft that is described in detail in the book, in my opinion, and I have no access to any classified information, is real.
This is now the huge triangular-shaped object so many people are seeing?
Right, and I think there are triangular-shaped objects that belong to the visitors, and I think there are triangular-shaped objects that don't work the same way, but that belong to us and that are very cleverly designed.
I think you're right. And these are the vehicles that they've kind of got a star look to it at night. They bring them out only at night, apparently, and they kind of blend in. People have seen this, Whitley, and they said, my God, the stars are all moving, but it's this craft that has
right.
a star-like bottom to it.
Well, I'll tell you another thing I think it does. It's interesting. That this craft will send out what is essentially a little like a plasma that it may be a small flare that will shoot off into the sky at high speed, very bright, and it looks like a UFO shooting off into the sky when the craft is actually still there, and it's black and silent. And it looks like people think that they will say that they saw this black triangle and they were looking at it and suddenly it turned into a bright light and shot off into the sky.
Are you at a point now, Whitley, after all these years, that you can tell yourself, what is their agenda? What is going on here?
Well, yeah, I think I can. I think I have an inkling of that. Now, that said, there's also a large part of it I don't understand. I'd be the first to say that. But there was an article published in Science magazine back in April of 1977 by D.B.H. Kuiper and Michael Morris, two prominent physicists, speculating that if aliens were here, they would be very secretive because they would have an agenda, and their agenda would be to learn what we had to offer that was really new. In other words, they would be here looking for innovation because it would be the only thing that they would want from us, because they would have everything else that we might have, they would probably already have in space.
Right, unless they had depleted the resources or something like that.
Well, that's always been an interesting question, too, because if there is some resource, like, if this was 500 years ago and they had showed up wanting oil and they were drilling for oil, we wouldn't know what the heck they were doing.
Exactly.
And yet they would be taking a resource that later we really would be able to, we would consider incredibly valuable.
That's true.
That could happen too. And that is reflected in the book, in the idea of gravitite, which is in the book, which they're heavily involved. And this was interesting at that area of upstate New York around Woodstock and south of Woodstock, under the Shangam Mountains and down into Pinebush. There are iron tailings. One of the biggest iron deposits in the world is up there, and they were involved in that iron deposit. They were there. They were underground there. We heard them. We heard them, and they would come up out of the underground every once in a while. And I even found a cave where they would come in and out some. And so that I'm speculative in the book about this, but that they, I figured that maybe they're getting something from that iron. Maybe it's something that in 100 years or 500 years will really wish they had not taken.
Were you ever threatened by them?
Not really, no. I made the lady, the communion lady, mad a few times, but that was not hard to do. She's a testy soul. But no, I don't think I was threatened. I felt threatened, though. I felt very, very threatened because they were so creepy. And sometimes the way they would look at you, you'd think that this guy just wanted to suck you dry, and he was only being prevented by something that was, he was just trying real hard to seem a lot nicer than he actually was. And then I thought to myself, well, I don't want to become a shill for evil aliens, so that's why I always say we need to cut the cards. Because I really, to be honest with you, don't know exactly what's going on here, but I do know this, that it's terribly important. That, you know, we overlook it, we ignore it, we pretend it's not happening, the scientific community won't look at it, the government has got what parts of it has associated with totally covered up and classified. But boy, is it important. And it's important to every single one of us because the future of mankind is intimately involved with these grays and with all of the visitors from other dimensions or worlds. Inevitably, this must be true.
I sometimes wonder, Whitley, if we are really in trouble, that they'll come down and save us, but then I'm not so sure anymore.
That I would be surprised to see. They are very, I mean, if they were political, they would be libertarians, I'll tell you that. Oh, yeah.
Or a new party altogether.
A new party altogether. They are very laissez-faire. I mean, the personal responsibility issue. And I think that they operate not in, even in an army. I think there are these triads, but I think that they're pretty much on their own, and I don't think that they operate on, there's some kind of a basic law where they all follow, which is they are very, very secretive. I've tried zillions of ways of getting proof of their existence. I could never do it.
Are you glad that this experience has occurred for you, or would you prefer that it never had happened?
There was a time when I would say I preferred never it happened, but that's not true now. I've gotten far enough away from it. I no longer wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning. I was still doing that a couple of years ago. I've got some perspective on it now, and I look back on it and I think this was truly a peak human experience. And I have had, and lots of other people have had, and we live our lives. And none of us really realize what's happened is that we are being introduced, for better or for worse, to the true greatness of this universe we live in. It's an incredible thing to be a part of.
It really is. And it is so exciting to be able to, just knowing you as I do now, which is definitely not as well as Art has, in understanding you and the conviction and the belief is pretty exciting for me. Because, you know, as you know, Whitley, we interview a lot of people, you know, and some people may concoct stories, others believe what they see. In your particular case, I pick up that something has really happened to you.
Well, I'm going to tell you what I saw. What I'm not going to tell you is necessarily what that really was, because I don't necessarily know. But I can tell you what my perceptual organs and saw, and what picked up, and what my brain thought it saw.
And I tell you, we can't ask for anything more than that, and you're doing that for us. Stay with us, Whitley. We have one final hour to go. And now it's your turn. We're going to open up the phone lines and give you a chance to talk with Whitley Strieber as well. Also, when I come back, I've got to find out about this movie that the book The Grays is being turned into, that Sony Pictures is putting together. We'll be back in a moment. Whitley, what's it like to see your work turned into a movie, like The Day After Tomorrow from the book The Coming Global Superstorm and now The Grays?
Well, it was really awesome seeing the Day After Tomorrow after we did Superstorm, because I thought it was an important story, and the way they did it, they did a very good job of it. It was a wonderful movie, and I think The Grays is going to be also a wonderful movie. There are some very talented people involved in it. The writer, Ken Nolan, is a very, very talented guy, and I've read some of his script. I'm one of the co-producers, so I'm privy to the whole process. And the other producers, Carrie Brokaw has got a great track record. John Calley, of course, is a legend, having just come off the Da Vinci Code and many other big films.
Are they going to call it The Grays?
They're going to call it The Grays, yeah,
okay,
absolutely.
Okay, good, good. I would have liked to have seen Superstorm, but The Day After Tomorrow, I guess that's what they wanted as well, huh?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's their choice. I thought Superstorm was a better title, too. But they chose Day After Tomorrow.
I guess
it was because he wanted to make the point that this could be happening, and it could be happening soon. And unfortunately, that is all going in the wrong direction still. I wish we could have better news on that front, but so far, no, that's not happening.
What was art like in New York? You guys all went up there for the premiere, didn't you?
What was art like in New York?
Yeah, what was he like in New York? I mean, did he enjoy New York, or coming from the desert?
No, of course not. Well, he didn't enjoy New York. Art Bell enjoyed New York? No way. We managed to get a steak dinner in him. His steak was no good, though. I mean, neither was mine, for that matter. We went to this great steakhouse, but apparently the assistant chef was the one who got assigned to our meal. My steak was one of these things where you get your fork and knife into it, and you might as well forget it. Now it really belongs to an archaeologist.
Yeah.
You're not getting those utensils out of there.
Nothing worse than one of those.
The cost was, of course, New York prices, so Art noticed that, too. No, we had, I'll tell you, though, we did have a certain amount of fun at the opening, but the problems were, you know, but they didn't really give us the credit. You know, our book didn't get credit in the lead titles of the movie, and that was embarrassing. That felt, and Art felt that too, I'm sure.
Yeah, they should have exploited that. Yeah.
Instead, they wanted to hide us like we didn't exist. And you know, the thing is, by far the two biggest. I mean, there were three really big names: Randy Quaid, me, and Art.
Yes.
In this project, and they should have used us.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. When does The Grays come out?
The movie, I don't know. That's the other thing. You know, they're working on the script now, and once the script is finished, it's going to go very quickly. But until the script is finished, I really can't answer
okay.
that question.
So, but maybe the end of 2007? That's a possibility?
That would be a real possibility, I would think, yeah.
Okay, and of course, the book is out now, as I mentioned, right?
Right, yeah.
All right, to the phones we go. Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on the air with Whitley Strieber on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing tonight?
Good. Go ahead. Where are you calling from?
I'm a trucker going across Pennsylvania. I'm headed through State College right now.
Okay, sir. Go ahead.
Hey, when I was a kid, I remember my parents asking me about this clear, gooey stuff that was like on the wood floor that we had at home, you know. They'd find it in the morning, and then 20 years later, I got a 9-year-old kid. And my wife and I are finding the same stuff in his bedroom. And we couldn't explain it or anything, and we didn't know what to do with it. So, you know, we got rid of it, and we didn't know. Maybe you could tell the listeners what they could do with stuff like that if they find it.
Clear, gooey stuff? And you have no idea how it got there?
No, absolutely not. It's just unexplainable, you know.
Whitley, did you ever come across that stuff?
Unfortunately, no. I would have had it tested 6 ways from Sunday if
yes.
I had. No, I never came off across any residue like that, and I never heard of anyone else coming across any residue like that either. As I say, if I had, I would have, and if this gentleman has any access to it, please collect it and drop me a line at whitley@streiber.com. That's STRIEBER.com or whitley@unknowncountry.com. And we'll take it from there. We would very much like to test this.
Absolutely. Caller, is it this, can you still obtain it?
Well, yeah. Well, we can't, but what I'm going to do is tell my boy when he has a son, when he's 8 or 9, to look for it and then take care of it. You know, because I've never seen it again.
That's weird. Okay.
Well, if it ever does show up again, do remember to send me a drop me a line because we'd like to collect it and do what we can with it.
Woodley, I get so many calls from people who are saying, "Okay, where's the evidence? Where's the hard evidence?" And we're not talking about photos, some of which look pretty authentic, some of which could be doctored, especially with computers now. But what about the hard evidence out there? Does anybody? And Roger Lear, of course, would say that he does have some of the implants. But does anybody really have some hard evidence out there that we could obtain, that we could find?
Well, the closest thing I ever found, actually, was that material called Art's Parts. That stuff was emitting something, some kind of an energy that we could never detect, and we found this out by accident. We did electron microscopy on it and all kinds of stuff, and it was relatively normal, but other parts of it were a kind of a foamed, mixture of magnesium and, I want to say barium, but it was in layers. And what was so weird about this, and we looked at this under an electron microscope, was the molecules, the layers weren't being held together by anything. In other words, you could see space between the clear space between the molecules. And under the electron microscope, and how could that be? There was no glue, there was nothing, there was no thing causing this adhesion. And yet it was layered like a sandwich, and also the foaming of the magnesium. We don't know how to do that either. I mean, that was a really, really weird thing. The other thing that we found out about it quite by accident was that some of the metal parts that were in, not the foam, but just the metal parts, were emitting some kind of radiation that would gradually over time scorch paper. And we could not detect what that was at all. We do know that it was causing the temperature on the very surface level of the paper to scratch. And we also found one piece that we could not identify the metal at all.
I have a friend of mine when he was a reporter, and we're going back to the early 70s. He's in St. Louis, and they get called to go to a place called Ellsbury, Missouri. They go up there, Whitley, and the sheriff is showing them around, and he shows them, first of all, in a big circle that obviously something had scorched. And there was a dead cow in the middle of the circle, the scorched circle, as if it were dropped right down into it. And other cows were kind of walking around the circle. Now, this is a very close friend of mine and a reporter. And when they tell you these stories and these people you trust, you believe them. He said the weirdest part of everything was on the side of a tree, there must have been 10,000 scorched dead flies just kind of burned right into a side of the tree. And he said, "I'll never forget it." But the reason they were called out there were because neighbors were seeing strange lights in what they thought might have been craft coming really low. And so they went rushing out there with a camera crew. Of course, everything was gone by that time, except these items that I just mentioned. And that was a weird story. Etched flies, thousands of them, on the side of a tree.
That is very bizarre. It's something I've never heard of before at all. We had a situation where there was a rancher down in South Texas who was having something odd happening in a feedlot. He had a little circle in the grass in this feedlot, and his cattle were acting very strangely. So I gathered up a little team, some scientists from Southwest Research who were interested in this stuff. We took a magnetometer and some collection equipment, a video camera, a few other things down there to see if we could get any kind of a reading of any kind. Yeah, and we got there, and this man was very understated. One of these Texans who sort of talks like this, my cat's acting kind of strange at, you know, kind of thing. And we get there, and the whole these cows are standing with their heads in this circle, you know?
Yeah.
And you have to kind of push them away and drive them away in order to get into the circle. We got, he got his dogs out there and got them all away from the circle, and we collected dirt from the circle and found that it was full of these little pieces of magnetite. The dirt around it wasn't. The magnetometer, which I was manipulating, was moving around the circle, was giving off very bizarre readings. And the thing that's strange about it was it was giving off readings, and it not only would it the readings go crazy, but the magnetometer itself would make an odd noise that no one could explain when you moved it quickly through the circle. And, I mean, it was just off the walls that it would be doing this. And then I got absolutely exhausted. It was like a vampire. It sucked my blood out of me, and I had to go sit in the car, just about collapsed. And I was like that for another 24 hours.
Just took the energy right out of you.
The energy right out of me. Then we found that when we looked at the videotape that we had made of the thing, primarily of the collection process, that every time the video camera was pointed at the circle, it took no picture. It was just the video. There was nothing but the usual Brownian movement on the tape. There was no image. So, you know, that was evidence of some sort, but what? Of what?
I love it. Wildcard Line, your turn. You're up on the air on Coast to Coast.
Hey, George. How you doing? Joe from Boston, WRKO.
Sure, Joe. Hi.
Hey, Whitley. How you doing?
Hey there.
Three questions, Whitley, and I hope you're not offended by these. One is about about the evidence. Why don't these people come down and help people like me or others who are on a fixed income? Because I have a videotape that was on TV a long time ago. I don't know how long it'll last if the videotape will hold up. You know, they wear out of a John Salters who was met by the UFOs. He was in his truck. He was given medical care and everything. That's the first question. And the second one is about your book. Can you try and put your book on audio like George is doing?
Well, he did. No, it is. It is.
Was it on CD?
It's a series of CDs, yeah.
Oh, okay. I didn't know where to go get it in the store. And the third is, can you help us who can't see get in touch, get on your mailing list for your unknown country? Because I tried calling that number, and I have just a recording. And, you know, the equipment for us isn't as good for visually impaired people because we do need help. I like hearing the free shows, you know, on your website. I enjoy them. But where is this so-called evidence? Why don't they come down and meet with people and help people and straighten out and make that miracle happen, which happened to Mr. Salters? I don't remember where he's from, but he was real. I've got the videotape.
All right. We'll let you listen on your radio, Joe. Thanks for the question. Why don't they make themselves so known, Whitley?
Yeah, I agree. That's what I'm about, in a way, is trying to get something to happen. You know, yes, I would like to see them known, make themselves known too, as long as they don't turn out to be monsters, then they can go to hell.
Well, see, and it makes me realize they might be.
Of course they might be.
Yeah. I mean, if they are kind of clandestine in this whole thing, to me...
One of the things I heard that my uncle told me, or maybe it was Art Exon that told me, one of the two of them told me this. One of them told me a good story, and one of them told me a very scary story, was this. That a scientist called John von Neumann, who was a very prominent guy back in the early 50s, the press used to call him the smartest man in the world and things like that, had written a paper. He was into quantum physics, saying that the danger was that let me see if I can explain this right. This is hard. That they could not enter our reality without our having a basic fundamental belief in their existence, as fundamentally as we believe in a table or a chair, that we, because they've never been part of our reality, they literally have a limited ability to affect us. But he feared that disclosure, that if the government were to say they were real, it would possibly be like a tripwire, and it would open a door that could never be closed again without us knowing in advance what that would be like.
I believe that. That's true. You know, and Hoagland keeps bringing up the Brookings report from years gone back that basically says we can't handle it.
Well, see, that I don't think. I mean, if we can't handle it, then what's wrong with me? Because I was.
Well, you could be a rarity. You could be a rarity. You're handling it quite well.
Well, I know a lot of people. A lot of people handle it. You know, there's people who are deeper into it than I am.
Well, did you always handle it well?
No, it took years to get to the point where I handled it well. It was hard. It was terribly scary. I still to this day can't tell you what in the heck made me go out there. But I want to get back to his questions. First of all, about Unknown Country and the visually impaired. Unknown Country offers a rich experience of audio, just like Coast does. And that's what we have there for the visually impaired. I unfortunately cannot afford to do things like have readers who read the website so that the visually impaired can also listen to the news and so forth. Unfortunately, I wish I could, but I cannot. The newsletter is all written. So there's nothing there really for the visually impaired. What he should do is what he continues to do, which is to listen to the shows, and that's available. That's what I have to offer. As far as the visitors coming and curing people, there was a talk show host, a really really one of these guys. I'm trying to remember his name. You would remember him. He's passed away.
Was it Long John Neville?
Not Long John Neville, but it was a guy like that. One of those guys. And he had had, I went on his show when he was a radio host in Chicago. And he was very nice to me. And I was astonished because, you know, here I come with this UFO story and I expected him to eat me alive. And he was very nice, very open-minded. It turned out he had not only had he had a close encounter of the third kind, where he was driving down the road and it entered this strange fog in his car and there was this big light in it, and he ended up aboard a craft with aliens, but he had terribly bad teeth. And afterwards, his teeth were fine.
They fixed his teeth?
They fixed his teeth. And you would think he had to be bluffing, but he wasn't. I talked to him privately. He didn't talk about this on the air. I talked to him privately about it. He talked to me, brought it up privately. And I went on TV with him. And on TV, he was still very nice to me because of he had a big play on TV. Gosh, I wish I could remember his name. It's very embarrassing.
Maybe somebody send us a little fast blast note on that, Woodley. We'll get the answer before we're off the air. We'll take final questions as well with our special guest tonight, Whitley Strieber on Coast to Coast AM. And back with Whitley Strieber, final segment with your calls. Whitley was the talk show host out of Chicago. Was that Morton Downey Jr.?
Morton Downey Jr., yeah.
That is him.
And he, you know, he perpetrated a hoax once of having a Nazi insignia painted on his face and things, but he never talked about this publicly. So I think it probably happened.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
You know, he never said a word. It was a private thing, and he's passed on now, and I have no compunction about saying he never told me not to tell anyone about it. So I think, you know, it's an example of what that guy was talking about, and there's the feeling that, you know, you listen to a man who's visually impaired asking for this help, and there's a feeling that if they could do that with Morton Downey Jr., why don't they help us? And I, you know, his question is a good one.
And maybe it's selective. I don't know.
that makes it even more frustrating in
yeah,
my mind.
Yeah, it does. Wildcard Line, welcome to the program. You're on with Whitley Strieber. Hi there.
Hi, it's Robert from Los Angeles.
Hey,
hi, Whit.
Bob.
Hi.
Hey. Yeah. Gosh, I've worked around the aviation for many years, and Lockheed, when they're building the F-117 stealth fighter in Burbank, and when that was completed, the project, as its first term known, was Have Blue. And if you notice, a lot of the projects that have the name Blue in it have something to do with UFO reconnaissance and surveillance. And the aircraft, when they first were released and tested, since when we develop a new type of technology, we use that technology to conduct surveillance on UFO activities, because they haven't built a crack that technology yet since it's new. And I was sort of wondering, what really got my attention is when you talked about the Aurora, because when I left, they were just starting Aurora, and that was being built in the Groom Lake facility. You're aware of that, right?
When did they leave? When did you leave?
This was back in, this was like 89, 90, and they asked me before I left. They said, we have a problem with they had a major problem with the Greek G-forces on the pilot, and it's really ironic. And you said the same thing. I was like, I wonder how the heck this guy knew that. And the G-forces are incredible, but it is the fastest thing on Earth. We decommissioned in 91 the SR-71, which the Aurora replaced. And if you look at the SR-71, it was built, it was first designed in the 60s. That's like 40 years ago. That thing looks incredibly futuristic, more advanced than the aircraft that we know now. And that's 40 years old. So the aircraft that we're using now, the Aurora, it's used with a hydrogen propulsion engine system. And this thing takes off on the ground, and it goes in the low orbit. Actually, if you recall, do you remember STS show footage where they show the supposed ice crystals on the back that SDI shot at a UFO? And
oh, yeah, it's a great piece of video.
Well,
yeah,
you know
I've got that video somewhere up on my website. It's an extraordinary piece of video.
If you look closely at the video, I've seen an edited version of that video. That's not the big thing of the video. If you look at it, the edited version is grainy. If you look at the not grainy version, it shows a wider angle. You look to the right of the space shuttle, you hear the people inside the space shuttle going, oh, my God, like that. The Aurora is right next to it. You'll see a black triangle with three strobe lights on each point next to the space shuttle, and that's why it was classified. It was on NASA Select. I picked it up on a KU band receiver. I'm a ham radio operator, so I pick up the downlink from the space shuttle whenever it goes up. And I was watching that. I recorded back when that happened, and I couldn't believe it, because what caught my attention is when the guys in the shuttle, they put their face up the window and go, oh, my God, like that. I go, what is he going, oh, my God, it? I looked, and then you could see the black triangle, the Aurora, sitting right out there, and they're pretty amazed. That's pretty neat to see that. But a lot of the people that worked at our facilities, listening to you with the UFO stories, most people think you're one can shy of a six-pack, but a lot of us who have worked in this stuff, we've had the exact same experiences. We've had weird things fly by the facilities where these are being manufactured, and I brought it up. I thought we were being shot at because these little projectiles are flying around. I talked to one of the guys. I said, I'm being shot at here. He goes, we know that. It's been going on since the 1940s. I said, what are these things? They're flying around. They're zipping around and zooming around. And they just said, hey, we don't know what they are. And then some of us have actually been, one employee that reported an abduction, they fired him. They terminated him. And a lot of us had discussions about this. They said, have you had anything weird happen at night? And he said, yeah, this light came up, this light before for me and a couple other employees. We had an orange orb come up to. They talked to me about it first, and I thought they was pulling my leg, but it happened to me. An orange orb came up to me, and I was gone for about 3 or 4 hours. And when I was done with all this, I couldn't even stand up. I was so tired, like they were going to do some sort of physical diagnostics thing. And I was just exhausted, and I went back and met with some people, and no one would talk about it. They're scared to even discuss this. And this happens like every 4 years to me, and they do something where it actually affects your ability to communicate. Like I have a hard time verbalize words. I have to actually go back to college and start learning things. Do you have the same problem, Whitney, where actually part of your mind is messed up?
There's a definite issue with verbalizing material that they don't want you to talk about. I struggle with that all the time. I've been struggling with it tonight, and I've made a few breakthroughs, actually, over the course of the evening. I've said some things that I haven't been able to say before, and so has Ann. She's was able to talk about some incidents where she had direct experiences that I wish she'd been able to talk about years ago, but it just would not come out.
This SDS video, Whitley, that we've all seen. What do you think it is?
Well, it's interesting that the pulse of light comes up from the area of it comes up from Australia, from Pine Gap, actually,
yes.
From right around there, and it suggests that if you just look and see what's there, and this is something I've gotten very interested in over the years, is I want to see what's there, what I can see, and that's what I'll report, and I'll not go any farther than that. And what you see, though, the thing is, most people, the scientists and so forth, they look at this thing, they won't see what's there. They won't say what's there. What's there is this. Pulse of light, something slowly moves towards the shuttle. I've never seen the aurora in that. I've never seen that video. I'd love to see that video.
Sure, me too.
Me too. And a pulse of light, a small lighted thing moves toward the shuttle, and it then makes a 90-degree and shoots away at great speed, and within a hundredth of a second, a pulse of light comes up from the below past the shuttle. And that pulse of light comes from the direction of Pine Gap in Australia, I think. I'm pretty sure that the man who told me that was what the shuttle was above was correct.
Now, did that pulse of light look like a trail of a missile or
No. Indeed
just light?
It's a discrete pulse of light of a kind that we cannot necessarily create, at least we don't know how to create, and at least not on the surface. Now, I'll go back to the man, the blonde man I talked to so extensively. I just alluded to that earlier, and I'll tell you a little bit more about what he said. He was adamantly opposed to the Greys, and he said that to stay away from them, that they were dangerous, and he said that his people had been in a war with them for millennia, and that the problem that we must not start a war with them, because if we did, they would never let us win or lose. We would have to fight then forever, and they were in this position of having to fight forever. And I was left thinking to myself, this is a really complicated experience. And maybe this man was not a blonde. And maybe he's not opposed to the Greys. Maybe this was the Greys warning me about the danger of fighting them. See what I mean?
Yeah.
So, but somebody was down there with a very advanced, what is obviously a weapon. If it hadn't been a weapon, the little object wouldn't have gone flying away from the shuttle.
Exactly. And then in that, it was clearly a 90-degree split.
Clearly. So here's what we know. Somebody who is apparently on the ground has a weapon that is capable of sending a pulse beam of light into space that is sufficiently dangerous to a UFO to cause it to go racing away. Is that the United States Air Force, somebody from another world who is fighting the Greys off for us, or maybe the Greys are the good guys and whoever was fighting them off is somebody who's captured us? You just don't know the answers to any of those questions. And the key thing, and as Ann talked about earlier, she said, I'm the family skeptic. I may quickly keep the question open. The key thing is you don't close these questions. You don't make a decision. You just go with what you know, bit by bit. I have another relative who was in some of the very worst fighting in the Battle of the Bulge in World War II, and he said to me, what you learn on the battlefield is what I learned was this. Keep my head down, put one foot in front of the other, and don't worry about anything else. And that's kind of where I am with this business I do.
Absolutely. And just piece the pieces together one at a time.
Exactly. Go no farther than the facts you have take you.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're up with Whitley Strieber on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Kevin calling out of Bakersfield. I had a question for Whitley. You had spoke earlier that Nordics, I believe you said, had told you not to trust the Greys. Is there a possibility that they have different agendas for what maybe how we should evolve as humans or people on Earth?
Yeah, there's a darn good possibility that they do. But remember, the greater possibility is, in fact, what I know to be true, is we do not yet understand what they any of them are. I am just reporting what I heard and what I was said to me. I don't think that making the leap from there to understanding, to saying we therefore understand this, is a wise idea right now. This is why The Grays is fiction. It is a way of entertaining the different possibilities without saying this is definitely true. But if there is some sort of battle going on, then we'll join it in one way or another in time, and probably not very much time, because I have a feeling that as this planet deteriorates, whoever has an investment here that they don't want to lose is going to start to act in ways that we can see. And what that may mean, I can't even speculate, but I think that's going to happen.
Sometimes you think Michael Rennie's going to come down and we're going to have that kind of an approach. But, you know, to fire missiles or lasers or whatever weaponry we might have at them, to me it sounds suicidal, Woodley.
Well, if it's us and we really don't know what we're doing, then that's a mistake. That is definitely a mistake. I mean, the Grays, they were very patient with me. They took a lot of yelling and screaming and gunfire at times, you know, but I think they probably would have their limits, and if they are trying to do something here and we are impeding them, eventually we'll find out about it.
You said earlier that you had touched one, I guess.
Yeah.
What did they feel like? What was the texture like?
Well, there's two things about this. First of all, the first time I came into physical contact with them, my allergies went through the roof, and they told me not to eat chocolate, which was disappointing to me.
Yeah.
And I ended up having to go to an allergist because I was just non-functional, and he figured out that he was a very smart allergist, and he gave me all these tests and figured out the underlying allergies that I had and gave me injections for those. I took those injections for years. And so I was able then to eat chocolate again, but I've slipped my mind.
We're talking about their texture of their bodies.
Yeah, the texture of the bodies. That's right. There's two things. First, they were very soft. They were almost like touching smoke, like deer skin, or even softer than that. But on the one hand, on the other hand, they were, there was a strength to them sometimes. They seemed very slight and very fragile, but they could be, like one of them once jumped on my back, and its arms and legs were like iron. I mean, you could not even think about moving there was no give whatsoever.
They were that strong.
Oh, unbelievable. And this person was like, little and thin, maybe 3.5 to 4 feet tall at most, and with thin arms and legs, there was no sense of any muscle of any kind there, and yet the arms and legs were like iron, George. I could not even think about moving my arms or getting this person off my back.
Did you sense a compassion or a love coming from them?
In that case, yes. This was someone who, under the circumstances we were under, did not want me to leave and wanted to be with me. And that was what this was about. This was an attempt to get me to be with this individual. I say I'm careful not to say a sex, but it felt like a female. And, or maybe not, I don't know. I don't know if they even have sex, but that was my impression of it because of the way she was reacting to me. So there was that. But I think, though, and this is expressed in The Grays in various ways, there was a hunger to share my emotional life. that was really intense, and I have a feeling that's part of what they want from us, that they don't have necessarily, they're not emotionally rich, not like we are inside, and they know that, and they want what we've got. And I've thought to myself, you know, if they were intelligent machines, that somebody maybe, you know, getting back to John von Neumann, he conceived of something called the von Neumann machine, which for all I know could be the final truth about what the Greys are. The von Neumann machine was a machine that was a complete replica of a species with all of its everything, but it was mechanical. It was a machine, and it was sent out around the galaxy looking for another planet that it could establish itself on. When it found such a planet, it would then wake itself up and reconstitute the species on that planet. And it was all done with programming, supposedly, was the idea. And maybe the thing that they are missing is they are an intelligent machine of this kind.
They might be.
And they are missing the emotional content of real living beings. And they know that, and they don't know how to get it, and they're here like kids standing outside a candy store without any money in their pocket.
Whitley, I cannot believe it, but 3 hours has just zoomed by, my friend.
I have to tell you, George, it's fantastic. It's missing time. I can't believe
we have time travel together on this one. Hey, enjoy talking to Art again on Sunday night. I'll be listening.
I can hardly wait, and thank you so much, George, and everybody. It was a great, great experience tonight.
Good luck, and promise me one thing, that if you're in the L.A. area when you go to see the movie, let me tag along with you.
Well, I'll invite you to the premiere if we have a premiere, for sure.
I'd love to see it. Thanks, Whitley. You take care of yourself.
Thank you.
It's my way of getting a free movie. For Dan Galante, Steve Carr, Wayne Roberts, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell. I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.